Belshazzar's Feast, a wild celebration with a terrifying, cryptic message of judgment delivered in a manner that has even led poets, painters, composers to use it as a subject of artistic contemplation. Early Romantic period Lord Byron, who lived from 1788 to 1824, crafted two poems on the event. Somewhere between 1635 and 1638, Rembrandt executed a major painting, now in the British Museum, with the same title, Belshazzar's Feast. British composer William Walton wrote a cantata by the same name in 1931. Two phrases from the account are used in everyday English today. Well, this is the eighth in our series of studies in the book of Daniel, and I've entitled it Divine Use of the Profane. Divine Use of the Profane, where profane means something here spiritually dirty. Spiritually dirty. Well, what does Daniel chapter 5 mean? What's its purpose? I want you to look first and think first with me about Habakkuk chapter 1 and Habakkuk chapter 2. I've reproduced a few verses from there in your notes. In predicting the Babylonian captivity, as he wrote in the 7th century BC, Habakkuk records God's words in chapter 1 of his book. Chapter 1 and verse 6, I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. Habakkuk responds, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Chapter 2, Habakkuk in effect says, Lord, I want an answer. You are bringing something unclean on your people whom you love. I will take a stand, and I expect an answer. So he says, chapter 2 and verse 1, I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. He was so certain that he was right, that God would not bring something evil on his people. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. God says in chapter 2 and verse 4, see, the enemy is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous person will live by his faithfulness. So God tells the prophet that he will bring the Babylonians on Judah, as we have seen in our study of Daniel. It happened. Habakkuk questions how a holy God can bring something evil and spiritually profane on his people. The last quote gives the answer. God is pleased when someone trusts him in difficulties. God raises up something profane, shapes his children, and then destroys the tool that he uses. In Daniel chapter 5, we will see the destruction of Babylon, the instrument God used to shape the people of Judah. As Habakkuk did, we should at first think of what God is doing as something perplexing, a surprising way for a holy God to act. Habakkuk was so surprised that he said, God, I'll wait for your answer. I don't think you're right on this. How can you explain this? Isaiah speaks of this shaping, this chastising purpose of God, this way in chapter 28. In verse 21, the Lord will rise up as he did at Mount Perazim. He will rouse himself as in the valley of Gibeon to do his work, his strange work, and perform his task, his alien task. And indeed, Habakkuk thought that for God to bring the Babylonians on Judah would be alien to the nature of God. Here in Daniel, then, through one of the strangest scenes in all of human history, God teaches us about his very personal dealings with human beings. The facts of Daniel 5, rooted in history, although if you look at contemporary accounts of the fall of Babylon, they may mention that the Bible in Daniel chapter 5 speaks about this, but it's just pure conjecture. But I would say the facts of Daniel 5, rooted in history, they are history, point to a powerful and recurring spiritual fact. I put it in bold for you in your notes. God will use any means, even evil things, any means that he wishes to shape those he loves. Ultimately, the means isn't important, but the end product of increased godliness is of great and eternal importance. I hope that our study will encourage you to see how God works in your life, using even spiritually profane things in the world to make you more like Christ. Might be illness, might be loss of a loved one, might be someone doing evil things to you, but they're part of the plan of God to shape you and change you. So expect God to work this way, powerfully yet lovingly carrying out his shaping work for his children in the world. So here's the text of Daniel chapter 5, and it begins on October 11th or 12th, depends on what time of the night you're looking at, but Babylon fell on October 12th, 539. So if it was later in the night, it was the 12th. If it was earlier, by our reckoning, it would have been the 11th. But it's the night of the 11th and 12th. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. I would comment, large feasts of this kind were known in ancient times, but this one was thrown as the attacking Persians were at the edge of the city. It was a celebration of doom. They knew what was going to happen. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem. Notice again, as we've seen in the last few chapters, repeated phrases. And the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, and they were all drunk. That's my addition. That's not in the text, of course. Belshazzar knew where the cups came from and brought them so they could be profanely used to worship Babylonian gods. They were toasting the Babylonian pantheon of gods. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. To the right of the text is Rembrandt's portrayal of that moment. If you look carefully, you can see his recording of the words that were written on the wall. You can see the single hand, no more than the hand, not even a wrist. The shock of Belshazzar, the people to his left or behind him shocked. The drink being poured out on the right, but being spilled because of the interruption by the hand. So suddenly the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. The king called out for the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought and said to these wise men of Babylon, Whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. He said this although he knew that the city would fall by the next day. I would comment that Belshazzar was a co-ruler, a co-regent under his father Nabonidus, so he was offering Daniel a position right under himself. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. Apparently it remained on the wall for a while. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. "O king, live forever," she said. "Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man Daniel, whom you call, the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams and explain riddles and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means." It's likely that the woman who came in was Belshazzar's mother, the wife of Nabonidus. Now, she says that Belshazzar's father was Nebuchadnezzar. The word father can mean father, grandfather, great-grandfather. And I'll mention in a moment some of the features of the lineage of Belshazzar. Secular scholarship today does not connect Belshazzar with Nebuchadnezzar. Nevertheless, the text says that they were related. Well, anyway, his mother, who scholars believe could have walked in to that orgy as she did, testifies to her high position. She requested the presence of a man who was now in his 80s and had walked with God all his life. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you were able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered the king, "You may keep your gifts for yourself and give your rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means." Seems that Daniel was reassuring Belshazzar that he would give an entirely objective interpretation, and so he took no gifts. So Daniel says this, "O king, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes." So we have information from the previous chapter that is connected with what is about to happen. The Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men, sets over them anyone he wishes, and by implication, he deposes anyone he wishes. Daniel goes on. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. That's interesting. He knew what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Hadn't affected him. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praise the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written, says Daniel, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsin. There is actually a single letter that means in Hebrew the letter pronounced U that appeared before Parsin, so it's Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parsin. This is what these words mean. Mene means God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. And notice that there are two occurrences of this word. So literally it is numbered, numbered. And undoubtedly the repetition is for emphasis. Your days are numbered, really numbered. This is the end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. It's interesting that the words are mentioned here for the first time in the account. Earlier there was a description of what was happening in the orgy and the hand doing the writing, but only here at the climax of the chapter are the actual words recorded. Much has been written concerning the meaning of the words. Were they in Aramaic? Were they in some other language? It is not clear what language they were written in, probably Aramaic, but in any case, Daniel gives a divinely inspired interpretation. So the text continues. Then at Belshazzar's command, he keeps his promise, Daniel was clothed in purple, a gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. The identity of Darius the Mede, by the way, has been the subject of considerable scholarly debate. Since he appears later in the book, we'll leave that question for further future study. The fall of Babylon is clearly attested in ancient literature, although the details of how the Persians captured the city are in debate. But during the party itself, the Persians entered the city after having diverted the waters of the Euphrates. That is in debate by some scholars, but most feel that that's what happened. They diverted the water into some dry lakes, in effect, and lowered the Euphrates, some believe, to chest height, waist height, so that Persian soldiers could essentially walk right into the city. Euphrates ran through the middle of the city of Babylon. So they marched in low water or dry riverbed, meeting no resistance. Babylon itself was not harmed, but Belshazzar was killed. Nabonidus, his father, was away from the city at the time, but apparently eventually surrendered not very long after this. Well, there are three key men in the chapter. And if we look at their careers and their appearance in the text, we can see God's shaping principle in clear display. First of all, Belshazzar is a prominent part of God's chastising tool. By the way, have any of you ever made something on a lathe? L-A-T-H-E, either out of wood or metal. Well, you probably know what a lathe looks like. At essentially waist height, you put a piece of wood or metal in the lathe, and there are tools that come down to shape that piece that you have put in. Or you might use, if it's wood, a chisel-like tool that you pass over and press into the wood with chips flying everywhere to make the shape that you want. And afterward, you come out with the shape and you put the tool aside. Tool is not important any longer. The shape, the object that you have made is what you want. I had the opportunity to do that one time with a metalworking lathe that my father had and made a small piece out of metal. I didn't know where I was going with it. And as I was moving along, I said, well, let's take a little off here, a little off here, and a little off here. It was steel, and I was using hard bits that were part of the lathe to shape that. Lathe wasn't important, the tool blades weren't important, but that little piece of metal that I had shaped was important to me, and I can still remember it. I was probably about 12 at the time. I remember also I tried making a baseball bat out of wood. I don't remember what kind of wood it was, and it ended up being a lot skinnier than I wanted it to be because I kept taking off more and more, and it was, I'd take a little off here and a little off here, and probably by the end, you couldn't even tell that it was a baseball bat, but I was pretty proud of it, and I put a finish on it. I don't know if I was ever able to hit a baseball bat with it. It probably would have broken. Tools were set aside. The lathe was no longer important. The baseball bat, at least to me, was important. God's chastising tool, Belshazzar, as the last in the Babylonian kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar died in 562 BC. His son Amel-Marduk succeeded him, but ruled for only 2 years. In 560, Nergalasser, and by the way, if you read different accounts, some accounts it's Nergalasser, in some accounts, contemporary accounts, it's Nergalasser. He usurped the throne and did away with him. Nergalasser reigned only for 4 years, dying in 556 BC. He was succeeded in a coup by his son Labashi-Marduk. By the way, these will all be on the quiz, so memorize them. And he reigned for 2 or 3 months. Nabonidus took over the throne in a coup in 556. And reigned until 539. Because he was away from the city for most of that time, his son Belshazzar ruled in his place, although Belshazzar never acquired the title of king. Belshazzar was mainly an administrator, a manager. The text says that Nebuchadnezzar was his father, as I mentioned a moment ago. This could also mean grandfather or even great-grandfather. It's not clear from historians and archaeologists how this fits with the royal successions just described, but since the text of Scripture says they were related, then they were. The biblical account is undoubtedly conservative concerning the feast. It must have been an all-out orgy with filthy, idolatrous practices. We should not underestimate it. Archaeologists have found a room in the royal palace in Babylon measuring 56 by 173 feet. Could this be the scene? A key element in the feast scene is the golden vessels. Belshazzar's use of God's ordained instruments for worship in the temple in Jerusalem were a mocking of God. God brings about their theft many decades earlier. Then he removes the thieves. Apparently, they had not been so used or abused before this, the vessels. It's significant that the conqueror Cyrus returned them to the Jews. Verses 18 through 23 show that it was God who was removing Belshazzar, and with him the head of gold we saw in chapter 2. Belshazzar failed to learn what Nebuchadnezzar had apparently learned. The hand on the wall caused Belshazzar to fear his fate, probably because of his conscience. Belshazzar then was part of the instrument that God set up to chastise his people and demonstrated the profane nature of that instrument. But it was only temporary and only did what God willed. The fall of Babylon was the removal of the head of gold. Second key figure, Cyrus. Cyrus is a positive force used by God to remove the chastiser. Cyrus II, who lived from 600 to 530 BC, known also as Cyrus the Great or Cyrus the Elder, and founder of the Persian Empire, took the throne of Persia in 559 BC. Cyrus was one of the most enlightened and benevolent rulers of ancient times. By 550, he had conquered the Medes and other peoples that eventually became part of his domain, and his kingdom eventually exceeded the Babylonian Empire in size. Part of the trend that we saw portrayed in the statue dream of Daniel 2, where the second kingdom was larger than the first and the third larger than the second geographically, and the fourth larger than the third. Today's Iranians, by the way, are descendants of the ancient Persians. They are Indo-Europeans, and they spoke a language related to Greek and then related to Old German and therefore related to English. By the time of the events in Daniel 5, and by the way, the Babylonians were not Indo-Europeans, nothing in their language in common with ours, but commonalities in Old Persian. By the time of the events in Daniel 5, Cyrus had essentially encircled the city of Babylon through his general Gobiru, and Gobiru was at the point of overthrowing the city while the feast was going on. Now, the text doesn't tell you that, but history contributes to the tension of the moment that Belshazzar certainly must have felt. Did he think, did he begin to understand that the writing on the wall had to do with his downfall and the carrying out of the surrounding of the city? Probably. Cyrus' rise to power is God's doing to bring about Israel's release and return their return to Judea. And it is God who gives him the victory over Babylon. God raises him up in a gracious and positive way to move Israel's chastiser. The lathe tools are taken away. The object is done. Two centuries before the events of this chapter, Isaiah predicted Cyrus' role under the hand of God. Predicted 200 years earlier. Here are the words of Isaiah 1 through 4 and verse 13 in Isaiah 45. I encourage you to read the whole chapter. I have reproduced it at the end of this study for you, and it contains powerful teaching on the sovereignty of God. So Isaiah 45, 1 through 4 and verse 13. Think of how detailed this prediction is. This is what the Lord says to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I take hold of to subdue nations before him and to strip kings of their armor. This is the only time that the word anointed is used of a secular king. To open doors before him so that gates will not be shut. I will go before you and will level the mountains. I will break down gates of bronze and cut through bars of iron. By the way, contrast this, or compare it, I guess, with what we showed from Habakkuk at the beginning of this study this morning. God said, I'm going to bring the Babylonians on you. In Habakkuk, Isaiah 45, I'm going to bring Cyrus to stop what the Babylonians were doing. The shaping tool is removed. I will break down gates of bronze and cut through bars of iron. I will give you hidden treasures, riches stored in secret places, so that you may know that I am the Lord, the God of Israel, who summons you by name. 200 years earlier, God says, I'm going to bring Cyrus on Babylon. For the sake of Jacob, my servant, of Israel, my chosen, I summon you by name and bestow on you a title of honor, though you did not acknowledge me. I will raise up Cyrus in my righteousness. Didn't that same kind of phrasing occur in Habakkuk? Habakkuk says in 1:13, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You are righteous God. I will raise up Cyrus in my righteousness. I will make all his ways straight. He will rebuild my city and set my exiles free. By the way, the city was not really damaged as it was taken that night. But not for a price or reward, says the Lord Almighty. 2 Chronicles 36:23 and Ezra 6:3-5 record Cyrus' decree made later in 539, same year, allowing Judeans to return to their land. A benevolent king. And finally, after Belshazzar and Cyrus, what we learn about this third figure is fairly obvious. Godly Daniel was remembered in a time of need and called by Belshazzar's mother. His politeness and composure at a terrifying moment are a result of his faith in having walked with God for 80 years. By divine illumination, God revealed to him the meaning of the cryptic message, which no one else understood. We should see him as a symbol of God's people surviving when the shaping tool is removed. Daniel, representative of Judeans in Babylonian captivity, still alive, still able to go back to the land, back to Jerusalem, and Daniel is, in a way, a figure of Israel still being alive. Well, there are several sub-lessons that we can draw from this chapter. The role of the man or woman of God is always crucial. We learn that some people fail to learn the lessons they see taught to others. Daniel emphasizes that for Belshazzar. And the lesson of judgment falling on the profaning of sacred things. But most importantly, for the chapter as a whole, we have an example of God using the world to chastise and shape his own. In his wisdom, when his shaping work is complete, the instruments of chastisement disappear and his children are left changed. Here are some key principles associated with God's use of his instruments in the world. First of all, the shaping tool is often temporary, but for some it may last a whole time. The shaping tool for Judeans was temporary. It was removed here. For some who have lifelong affliction, that shaping tool will last till they go to be with the Lord. A second key feature of God's shaping is that you are more important than the tool is. The end product, change in your life, is more important than God's tool. So the disease, the illness, the accident, the injury, the loved one away from the Lord, the loved one who's not saved, the evil done toward you, you're more important than that tool is. Third, God's goal is always to shape us in love. How foolish for the Christian to say, if you love me, if there is some difficulty that I have, you must not love me anymore, God. Not true. God's goal is always to shape us in love. And God will only allow the instrument to go so far. October 12th, 539 BC was the end for the Babylonian instrument. Hebrews 12:11-12 summarizes this beautifully. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness. Not just righteousness, but a harvest, a bounty. Think Thanksgiving table full of more food that you could, than anyone could possibly eat. A harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. Trained by it. That's the shaping. Writer to the Hebrews describes discipline shaping as training. Therefore, strengthen your feeble arms and weak knees. Learn to think how God raises up people, events, conditions in your life to shape you as you look beyond them to the end product under God's hand. I want to close with the poem Belshazzar's Vision by the great early Romantic poet Lord Byron, who lived from 1788 to 1824, short life. It captures many of the theological and spiritual issues taught in our passage. He was not a believer. Notice how many true, valid, theological, and spiritual points there are in this poem. The king was on his throne. The satraps thronged the hall. 1,000 bright lamps shone o'er that high festival. 1,000 cups of gold in Judah deemed divine. Jehovah's vessels hold the godless heathen's wine. In that same hour and hall, the fingers of a hand came forth against the wall and wrote as if on sand. The fingers of a man. A solitary hand along the letters ran and traced them like a wand. The monarch saw and shook and bade no more rejoice. All bloodless waxed his look and tremulous his voice. Let the men of lore appear, the wisest of the earth, and expound the words of fear which mar a royal mirth. Chaldea's seers are good, but here they have no skill. And the unknown letters stood untold and awful still. And Babel's men of age are wise and deep in lore, but now they were not sage. They saw, but knew no more. A captive in the land, a stranger and a youth. Well, at the beginning he was a youth. Lord Byron got this wrong. He was in his 80s by now. He heard the king's command. He saw that writing's truth. The lamps around were bright, the prophecy in view. He read it on that night. The morrow proved it true. Belshazzar's grave is made. His kingdom passed away. He, in the balance weighed, is light and worthless clay. The shroud, his robe of state, his canopy, the stone, the Mede is at his gate, the Persian on his throne. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this historical account of the fall of Babylon as you bring to a close that period of testing and shaping for the people of Judea. Thank you that we know so much about the historical things that happened even on that night, and we're reminded of your power to raise up kings and to depose them at will, and here for the purpose of shaping your loved ones. We give you thanks in Jesus' name.